Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. Nate Bowling currently teaches political science and geography at the American Community School of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. He is a past Washington State Teacher of the Year and National Teacher of the Year finalist. He and his wife blog about living and teaching overseas at bowlingsabroad.com, and he's the host of the Nerd Farmer podcast on the Channel 253 podcast network. Nate, how do we engage students during this time of political upheaval? We've got Roe v. Wade, the January 6th Commission, the Russia-Ukraine war, the racial justice movement, and climate change, among so many other things. How do we bring students into this conversation?
I would argue that students are more engaged than many adults are on these matters, but the issue is they don't have productive or effective outlets for that engagement. The TikTok generation is very, very well versed in what's happening with the Supreme Court, what happened with the election, and on the Russia-Ukraine conflict and like its fallout in their economy. But the issue that they're experiencing is one that I think a lot of adults are experiencing as well, is it's one thing to be informed and engaged, it's another thing to actually make change. And one of the things that I'm pretty convinced about is that we're entering a period of like democratic decay, where essentially the popular will in the majority does not have the ability to get what it wants, and that leads to like frustration and upheaval. So maybe the issue isn't really engagement, the issue is that the system is not responsive to popular will.
That makes sense, because it seems like there are so many people that are cut out of the process. Yeah. Is there a way to reverse that?
There's a longer conversation to be had in the United States and in Washington State and in local municipalities about like what we actually mean by democracy and whether we want to have a democracy. Like, democracy in its purest sense is the people get what they want, and that's not what the founders intended. But at the same time, the founders put counter-majoritarian checks in the system, but they did not mean to have minority rule. And in many ways in American politics, we have minority rule. Whether you're looking at states where like large portions of the population are not allowed to vote because of restrictions, like in Florida, a massive number of black Americans are disenfranchised. Or you're looking at the U.S. Senate, where like a minority of the population's representatives are able to block things through procedural motions. Or you're looking at Electoral College, where the Republican candidate has won the popular vote, what, once since 1992? We have these counter-majoritarian forces, which basically are squashing popular will. If the majority people have things that they want to see done in society, and they're constantly getting rebutted and rejected by the minority, that's going to lead to frustration, that's going to lead to aggravation, and it's going to lead to political disengagement. And you cannot have a democracy with a disengaged populace.
That's what I'm worried about, because I talk to students and they feel overwhelmed, they feel disenfranchised, they feel powerless. How can we give them a sense of hope and a sense that they have the power to alter their future for the better?
One of the really concrete things that we can look at is the initiative process in Washington State. So Washington State has one of the highest minimum wages in the country because of initiatives. Washington State legalized marijuana because of initiatives. Washington State legalized same-sex marriage because of initiatives. Washington State legalized charter schools because of initiatives. Initiatives provide an outlet for direct democracy, allows us to circumvent our legislative and executive institutions. But the thing worth pointing out there is that what that means is those institutions have not been delivering what the people want. And so there's no process for an initiative at the national level. Something that I talk about in my classroom a lot, and like for context, I teach American government politics and comparative politics to U.S. students overseas. We talk about the idea that most policies that impact your life happen at the state level. Whether your schools are funded is a state issue. Whether your roads are paved are a state issue. Thanks to the Supreme Court, whether you have access to an abortion is now a state issue. In the near future, same-sex marriage may be a state issue. And so if all these issues are being resolved and happening at the state, that's where more of our energy needs to go. But if you look at the political discourse and look at political culture and look at political communication, it's all about national, national, national. What we're experiencing right now is a decentralization of authority in the United States and like a strengthening of the power of states. And we need to adapt our civics education and approaches to address that. Like, the most important decisions about how a child is educated, what happens with transit, what happens with public health are all happening at the local level, not at the national level. But all the energy is on the White House election every 4 years, not on city council, not on legislature, county council, public health.
Yeah, and it seems that because of that, there's a lot going on at the state and local level that is kind of flying under the radar, and that we are seeing this disenfranchisement and the minority rule and policies that are definitely dismantling equity, anything that was resembling it. How can we wake people up about that?
I don't think you can wake up a nation that doesn't want to be awoken. I think you just have to operate in the states. I'm famous and infamous for like mentioning the books that I'm reading in conversations, so here I go. I'm currently reading Michael Lewis's The Premonition, which is Michael Lewis. He's the author of The Big Short, The Blind Side, all these books, his take on the COVID pandemic. One of the things he says is that we don't have a national public health system. We basically have 5,000 public health systems that are all kind of like operating on their own, doing their own thing. And then the people in charge of them are not like big state officials. It's some county guy. So like I'm from Pierce County. Anthony Chin runs the Pierce County Health Department. Anthony Chin reports to the county council. And so they're who's in charge of public health in Pierce County. That's where COVID response and pandemic response either like succeeded or failed was at the local level and at the state level. We're entering into a period in which like the national government is basically saying, we don't want to decide these things. And if we do decide these things, you're not going to like the answer. And so it just seems to me that like the solution is to, again, just put that effort into state institutions. But what that means is that people have to be aware. We all know like the anecdotal data and like the conversations, like most Americans can't name their congressman. Well, most Americans really can't name their state legislator, right? Yeah. And so like, I think that's the impetus. One of the things that I did before I moved overseas is I hosted these events called Adult Civics Happy Hour. And what they were was basically, they were civic engagement events where I would bring in a policymaker, a journalist, and an activist to talk about an issue. We talk about homelessness. We talk about how to run for office. We talk about combating violent white supremacy. We talk about housing costs. And like these were local convenings where basically adults were getting a re-education in civics on all the things they had like forgotten post-high school. And that's what a lot of adults need. It's funny, there's always this conversation about like student civic knowledge. My students that I teach, at least, and a lot of young people who I encounter are far more informed about what's happening in the United States and how power is structured in the United States than a lot of adults are. There's a different conversation to be had, maybe we'll get there,
yeah,
about civic education versus media literacy, because there's a definition of civic education that a lot of folks have in mind about what they want, and there's what I think people need right now in America, which is actually more media literacy and the ability to like confront information, confront misinformation, and then understand what good data is, what bad data is, what good anecdotes are, and sourcing and things like that.
Definitely, because truth is something that is not agreed upon right now. You can get easily into your own echo chamber and consume whatever information, whether it's true or false, that you want, essentially. Does that start at the school level with students to teach them media literacy?
Let's back up a step.
Okay.
One of the things that has happened over the last decade is there's been this like cry for civic education in Washington State schools. But what that means and what that looks like is in the eye of the beholder. People who tend to view themselves as being conservatives want civic education, but their definition and explanation of civic education is very fact-based and very history-based. Like, well, kids don't know about the Declaration of Independence, and kids don't know about the founding of the Constitution, and kids don't know about three branches of government. They do, but like, whatever. Folks who consider themselves to be politically liberal have more of a mindset about civic education being more centered around activism and like change making. I think there's room for both, but the part that's missing there is the media literacy piece that I think actually might be more important. Here's what I'll say. I teach an AP class that is like laid out in its structure by the College Board. I have a course articulation. Within that course articulation, I have the flexibility to do like whatever I want as long as I'm teaching information. The media literacy aspect and also the aspect of how local government works are underemphasized in most national civics curriculum, but arguably are more important for the near future of the United States. I would say to anybody who's listening to this right now, if you are a civics instructor or you're an advocate who wants civics instruction like to be increased in Washington State schools or to be improved in Washington State schools, there has to be an element talking about local government, state government, and tribal governments. And there has to be an element talking about media literacy and understanding misinformation. Knowing those two things is frankly more important than knowing what was in Fed 10 and 51.
One thing that I wonder about, because of this shift in power toward the state and local level and away from the national level, and this is going to sound alarmist, so I'm just going to put that out there, but that's kind of what got us into the Civil War, isn't it? This whole...
No, like, I want to say this carefully and thoughtfully. I'm really glad that I'm a Washingtonian and I love Washington State, even though I don't reside here right now. Like, I'm here right now. My home is here. My family's here. I pay property taxes here. We're heading towards a societal bifurcation. There are going to be states that are tolerant of same-sex marriage, tolerant of women having control of their reproductive rights, try, at least like on paper, to put restrictions on law enforcement and like the way they conduct themselves, that have progressive taxation and that have strong social safety nets. And there's going to be states that basically are the opposite of each one of those. I'm really glad that I'm a Washingtonian and not from where my parents were from. My mom was born in Arkansas in 1940. My dad, rest his soul, was born in Mississippi in 1930. Yeah, those states are just trending in a different direction. Something that I've been thinking about a lot is that I mentioned earlier on that the Republican Party has basically lost the popular vote. So if you're not following this, we know the president's elected via the Electoral College, but the Electoral College comes out of the popular vote state by state. Democrats won the popular vote 1992, 1996, 2000. They lost it in 2004. They won in 8, they won in 12, they won in 16, they won in 20. That means the trend over my lifetime is that electorally, people are trending towards wanting Democratic policies in high turnout national elections. Now, what happens in the House and the Senate is a different conversation, but essentially, I think that there's an element of the conservative movement who believes that they can no longer win national elections, and so they're going hard in the paint to control what they control in the states. What that means is, with the jurisprudence that they espouse about state control, that means that things that would be unthinkable a generation ago are going to be passed in these states. Like, the long and short of this is I'm really thankful to be a Washingtonian, and folks who are listening to this should be thankful to be Washingtonians. We actually live in a special place that is going to become a more special place, I think, in the near future. So, for example, I have an acquaintance who works in reproductive rights in Eastern Washington. The second the court delivered their verdict overturning Roe, her phone blew up and it was calls from people in Idaho.
Wow.
So public services that Washington State offers that our neighbors to the east don't offer are going to be stressed in the near future. Washington State, we know, is a place where there's high demand for housing. This is going to be a place people are moving into. This is a moment for people to get engaged in local politics, to be focused on local politics. In 2024, we're probably going to have an open race for the Washington State governor, unless Jay Inslee goes full FDR and does four terms. And so who the next governor is going to determine a whole bunch of things about who the advisors are and direction of the state. At this moment, I'm thankful to be in Washington State, but I understand that, like, we can't take what we have here for granted. We have to be willing to fight for what we believe in. We have to be willing to fight for well-funded schools. We have to be willing to fight for high-quality teachers. We have to be willing to fight for transit, because those things can be taken away. No political gains that are made are permanent gains. Like, we're seeing the erosion of many of the gains of the civil rights era happen right now.
Do we basically give up on the other states, like Arkansas, like Mississippi, like Texas, for example?
I don't think you give up on them, but like the old adage is when you get on an airplane is that the flight attendant tells you to put on your own mask first before putting it on like the child or the person you're accompanying. Mm-hmm. And so we need to defend and consolidate the gains that have happened in Washington State, while at the same time advocating for better policies at the national level in other states. Like, I'm not saying we need to write off Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas. I'm not saying we need to write off other states, but the fight to be had to defend what we have and to get gains is a local fight. I have a friend named Kamau, and he put something in front of me I think about constantly. Washington State basically has the GDP of Sweden. Hmm. What are we getting as a return on investment from government that Swedish citizens get within their country, and why is it citizens in Sweden can go to university basically for free, have healthcare, and don't have to worry about being in deep poverty in their aged years? The short answer is that Swedes aren't dumping massive amounts of tax money into the Pentagon budget, but the longer answer is Washington State can do better for its citizens.
Is there a way to bring this country together? Is there a way to stop that bifurcation that you're talking about?
Yeah, but it's a generational thing, right? Like, one of my least favorite anecdotes is George W. Bush, Donald Trump, and Bill Clinton were all born the same summer. So if you look at, like, the presidencies since, like, 1992, it's, sorry, Boomer, Boomer, Obama, Boomer, and then going back to somebody, Joe Biden, who's older than the prior ones. Like, we need a shift in ideas in Washington State, and we need a shift in ideas in national politics. Here's why I get unpopular. So you have to be 18 years old to vote in the United States. You have to be 25 to be in the House, 30 in the Senate, 35 for the president. So there's age discrimination built into our system when it comes to office, right?
Yep.
Listen, man, nobody over 64 is getting my vote going forward.
Wow.
This generation of people, left, right, have been basically fighting through the same culture war politics that they fought through in the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s up until today. Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, they're all octogenarians. And, like, no shade to octogenarians. I love my mother. She's an octogenarian. But I wouldn't vote my mother to run anything, so why would I vote for them to run things, right? Mm. The healing and the unity and the reconciliation that American politics needs cannot happen while sending the same culture warriors back generation after generation. We need some generational change and some ideological change in American politics. We need to sunset this current generation of leaders and get some new policymakers in who have a vision for the future and who have a vision, who have something to gain or lose in the future. Like in the big scheme of things, if I'm 85 years old and I'm like, tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, I'm protecting my legacy, I'm protecting my estate, I'm protecting my descendants who are gonna benefit from my wealth. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of things that are coming up and challenges we need to combat around education funding, around infrastructure, and hello, Eric, we haven't talked about climate yet.
Nah.
So on top of all this, there's like a warming climate issue.
Yeah.
The Nancy Pelosi's, the Mitch McConnell's, the Joe Biden's, and the Donald J. Trump's are not the people to lead us there.
Do you think Kamala Harris could be one of them?
I'm gonna dodge that question artfully and say this. I've always been a fan of governors as presidents. Governors have executive experience. Basically, they are the presidents of their states. And like when Jay Inslee came to my classroom back in 2017, I introduced my students as the president of Washington State, and we all laughed. If you are a governor, you have executive experience. You have experience pushing legislation through your state legislature. You have experience like creating budgets and negotiating that process. And remember that states cannot print money, so states have to balance their budgets every year. I'm looking at the crop of governors across the U.S., and like that's where I would like to see somebody rise up. I don't think senators make good presidents, and Vice President Harris's primary experience is being attorney general and being a senator and now being vice president, and that's not the profile of a leader that I'm looking for the change that we need.
What about Gavin Newsom in California?
I think Gavin Newsom's done a fairly good job as governor of California. I think his brand is toxic nationwide. This is not a partisan screed on my part. There's some quasi, fairly reasonable Republicans who, like, I think have done a good job as governors around the United States. The outgoing governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, I think has done a fairly good job, like, for who he is and the situation he's been put into. Yeah, Newsom's quite popular. I think that he would get murdered in media. Whoever it is, the person has to bring new ideas to the table. The biggest thing America is facing is a dearth of new ideas.
Yeah. And that goes back to our kids, you know, how to engage them. I'm thinking about even at the school level, beyond just engaging them in civics or media literacy, how do you just get them involved in school and being excited to be there?
I have this thing that I always keep in my head. I want my classroom to be a place where students feel like they would show up even if they didn't have to. Mm. And during COVID, I actually got to exercise with that, right? I always talk to my students about the immediacy of politics and how they may not think politics impacts them, but the choices that elected officials make impact them greatly. The one example I often use is, as I say to students, if people your age vote at the same levels that boomers and senior citizens do, then college costs would not be what they are, right? Like cutting Medicare and cutting Social Security is political suicide. But we've seen the cost of a university education go up by a factor of 10 over my lifetime. And that's because young people are not engaged in the electoral process. They're politically engaged, but in the electoral process. But there's a disincentive for them to be engaged in the electoral process if they feel like their vote is not doing anything or creating any change. It's kind of a snake eating its tail. Students engage in politics, but then they don't receive change or see change, so they disengage from politics, and then we complain they're disengaged. It's a cycle that we're kind of trapped in right now.
Yeah. How much do you think school climate plays into this?
There are environments in which educators like myself feel free to talk about complicated issues. We have opportunities to engage students in meaningful discourse, and there's environments where, like, they aren't. And so we've seen throughout last summer to this year the critical race theory moral panic and like the don't say gay legislation and like the whole grooming discourse, which is shameful and disgusting, should not be condoned by anybody.
Yeah.
We've seen a chilling of speech. I'm very forthright in my advocacy. I talk about these are teacher censorship bills and teacher speech bills. Back to that bifurcation, we have a portion of the country having a robust discussion about democracy, about the state of the world, about like what is to come. And we have a portion of the country being silenced. Like, I think the most egregious example, a high school teacher in Tennessee who was teaching a class on current events and used an article from Ta-Nehisi Coates and basically was terminated from his job.
Yeah.
If we're asking students to confront difficult issues in the near future, then we have to be able to lead them in having uncomfortable conversations. And the number of bills that we've seen passed by state legislatures, which come down to, I don't wanna hear about so many things, whether it's race, whether it's climate, whether it's sexuality and gender and personal liberties and rights, it's alarming to me. I've joked in the past that in my lifetime we're watching the gains and the Enlightenment be handed back. That's an over-exaggeration, but it's not by much.
Yeah.
So what about here in Washington State? I mean, things are better here than they are in other states, and we're a local control state. So you've got each district, often, like even in Seattle, for example, you've got each school making individual decisions about curriculum and climate and that sort of thing. What kinds of systemic barriers do you see preventing healthy school climates in Washington?
Well, so that same bifurcation I talk about at the national level is present here in Washington State. My wife hosts a podcast. It's called The Interchangeable White Ladies. And they did an episode, about a month ago, about basically a school book banning campaign in Kent, Washington, where a principal and a few select parents have gone after a school librarian about the selection of books he has in the library because these books address issues impacting the gay and trans community. You're right, Washington State's a progressive state. Washington State has protections for teachers. Washington State has. But like, we cannot go to sleep on that and sit on our laurels. We have to be engaged in making sure that we're being vigilant about what's happening. It would be really easy for me to go, well, in Western Washington, we have this, but in Eastern Washington, we have that. But that's not true. Like, the divisions are not red and blue. It's up to everybody to be very circumspect about these elections that are happening. In Tacoma, where I'm from and Vote For From Abroad, we basically had a CRT moral panicker who was running for the school board. Thankfully, she lost, but she would have been somebody who would have limited teacher speech and would have limited student speech in a way that like she desired in the name of preserving the reputation and greatness of the United States. I subscribe to the James Baldwin School of Politics. Like, I love the United States. It's where I'm from. Mm-hmm. I served in the military. My mother's a veteran. My father's a veteran. My stepfather was a veteran. My uncle was a veteran. My brother's a veteran. I love this country. Yeah. And it's because I love it, I reserve the right to criticize it ruthlessly and fight to make it better. Mm-hmm. I love Washington State in the same way, and that's how we should approach Washington State politics.
So how can we support educators to overcome these barriers? Like, if the school board does pass something that's restrictive, or are there other tools that we can give them, either at the state level or the local level, that can help create a better climate for students so that they can have these difficult conversations they need to have?
Yeah, so two-pronged approach. On a institutional level, I would like to see legacy ed organizations start establishing teacher defense funds or legal defense funds. When we see teachers being censored for their speech or being persecuted or prosecuted in municipalities or in localities, there should be a legal defense fund where we protect them. And that can be from unions or from foundations, from benefactors, whomever. The other thing is that like I always was very like proud about my practice. I had an open door in my classroom and I would invite parents in constantly. If you are a person who has concerns about speech in the classroom in which your student is learning, or if you are a person who's just curious about what's happening, contact your child's teacher and be like, hey, I just want to come sit on a class. Some folks may not be into that, but I love that. I love when parents came into the classroom because I'm proud of the work that I do as a classroom teacher, and we should all be proud of the work that we do because we're shaping this generation of people. Yeah, I would say if you have concerns about like speech and about this, engage with parents, engage with schools, be vigilant about what's happening, but then also we need to have a legal defense fund for folks who don't have the same protections we have in Washington State.
What if you're an administrator, like you're a principal of a building, and you notice that your school just isn't able to engage students, isn't able to engage families? What should they do?
So the family engagement is always interesting because I hear schools say, we don't have good family engagement. Hey, principal, ask yourself, is the culture in your school inviting to parents to engage? Is it worth engaging? I've done a lot of work around diversifying the teaching profession, and we've talked about how we need more black and brown people to go into education. And one of the responses I've gotten is that if I had a miserable experience in K-12, why in the hell would I want to return to it to work? Yeah. I don't have an answer for that, right? Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that our schools are welcoming places. We need to make sure that when parents show up that we're listening and not just talking. Mm-hmm. We need to have what we call a co-generative dialogue where like it's going back and forth, not just I'm the principal, I'm going to explain to the community what the community needs, that we're listening. Some schools do a good job of this. Some communities do a good job of this. Some places don't.
Nate Bowling currently teaches political science and geography at the American Community School of Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates, and he's a past Washington State Teacher of the Year and National Teacher of the Year finalist. Nate, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you'd like to learn more about League of Education Voters or support our work, please visit our website, educationvoters.org.